I will sit and flip pages the whole time I talk if I don't move that book. So, my name is Beth Hartley. I'm an alcoholic. And because of the grace of God, the fellowship and steps of AA and sponsorship, I've been sober since June 26, 1988. And that just amazes me. 10 days was a long time for me to not drink. And if you were around me when I was doing my 10 days, it was a really long 10 days for you. I was a little edgy after a day or two, but no problem here, you know. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to speak. It's always an honor to be asked to participate anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was funny. I was sitting here thinking, you know, when Beverly talked before about, you know, having this fit of anger even 7 years ago when she's been in Al-Anon all these years, and how quickly, you know, I can descend from spiritual giant to start over. And on the way out here, I had a long layover, and so I spent the time at Salt Lake City working on a workshop that I'm doing in a couple of weeks at a different retreat. And kind of the whole gist of it is just, you know, let everything be simply as it is. That you know, it's not that things are crap, it's that I editorialize that they're crap, you know. And so I was, you know, I got through this whole thing, and it's all in pain. I'm feeling it, you know, I'm feeling it because I've just written it, and now I know what I'm going to say and share with others and just feel the calm exude from me. And then I get to Seattle and got my rental car and went 18 miles the first hour. And and I'm like, I'm in the thank God for air conditioning in cars, because I, you know, I'm just like, come on, what is wrong with, you know, just rare. And I was like, well, so much for the spiritual giant part, you know, maybe some other day. But it doesn't take me long to revert back. Every now and then I forget and have my car windows down, and it's not a good thing. But I do, I try to drive better. My license plates actually say, yay, God. And I find it forces me to drive better, because I can't be out there being a jerk with yay God on my license plates, you know, like, screw you, have a blessed day, you know. So it really makes me more conscious of what I'm doing. And that, you know, that's what I learned here too, that sometimes we're the only big book people see. And that I can't just come be Ms. AA in here. I have to carry that out somewhere else. And I don't know why I'm telling you this, but here it is. So my first home group was in downtown Cincinnati. And so there was a pay parking lot right across the street from the church. And if there was a Reds game that day, I got sober in Cincinnati, Ohio. You might tell I don't sound very North Carolinian yet. I've only been there 5 years. But anyway, so my home group was downtown, and there was a pay lot across the street where it was just easier to park. But if there was a Reds game, you know, all those people would be taking up our parking places, so you had to go early. And I pulled in one day, and there was plenty of room. And I always parked, you know, like my parking space, and he wanted me to park over there. And I, you know, but I want to park over here. This is my space, you know. And he's like, please park over there. So, I, you know, of course I complied because I'm sober now. But I wheeled my car over so he knew how he had inconvenienced me. And I slammed my car door when I got out, and I huffed by on my way to my home group to be spiritual. And I got in my home group, and we had a really long greeter line, you know. So I'm in there, and welcome to East 4th Street, welcome to East 4th Street, welcome to East 4th Street. And I hear this guy takes my hand, I hear this voice go, oh yeah, we met. And I look up, and who is looking back at me but the parking lot attendant that I had just been such a jerk in front of. And I was about a year sober when that happened, and I'll tell you, I never forgot it. Because I thought, who would want what I have if I'm acting that way out there? You know, what am I going to do if I'm being a jerk at the grocery because the person in front of me has 14 items in the 12-item line, and 3 days later that cashier comes, so now I'm going to take it out on the cashier, you know, because she made me wait, and then she shows up as a new girl at my home group, you know, is she going to want what we have? So anyway, I don't know why I got off on that, but I did drink. I needed a drink. My husband says he white-knuckled it till he was 12, and then he just couldn't take it anymore. But I actually had a dad in AA. My dad got sober when I was 7 years old, and so I was the kid in the corner at open AA meetings with the coloring book. I was very familiar with alcohol. I knew it was a clean place. I knew the people were safe. You know, I knew it was a bunch of old men that drank coffee and ate donuts because I'd seen it myself. You know, they used to smoke indoors back, and I'd be on the floor coloring. If I got up to table height, everybody just disappeared. I knew everybody's shoes. And but, you know, I knew AA was around. And I don't really remember my dad's drinking much. He told me about some of it. He told me the tragedy and the lost dreams and the crushed hopes and everything that alcoholism had done. And I got to tell you, when I took a drink at 15, well, the first time I got drunk, I just felt bad for him that he had such a hard time. You know, it's like some people just shouldn't drink. But that certainly was not my case. And for me, what having a sober parent did was it made me very, very, very careful to never, ever, ever wonder aloud if I was an alcoholic. You know, because I've heard people speak and they'll say, oh, I just sat in the bar and said, I'm alcoholic, who cares? But when you got a sober parent around, you just kind of intuitively know that if you mutter that A word in the same sentence with your name, a big book's going to drop out of the sky and somebody's going to hand you a meeting schedule. And I had no intention of not drinking. I just relaxed when I drank. I wouldn't have told you I was uptight before, but I was an only child. We always lived next door to big families, so I just always kind of morphed into their family. Because even at 5 and 6 years old, I absolutely could not stand to be alone with myself. I was in bad company if I was alone. So I was either buried in a book, or I was over living at your house with your 10 kids so that I could just get lost in the crowd. Because if I was by myself, it was too noisy. There were all these voices in my head, and they told me you didn't like me, and they told me you only played with me because your parents made you, and they told me you were talking about when I fell down playing kickball last week, and on and on and on, and I wasn't good enough, and, you know, just all of that stuff. And this is in kindergarten and first grade, you know? I just couldn't. One of my favorite promises in the big book is the one that says we can be alone at perfect peace and ease, because that absolutely was not my experience until I came here. I couldn't just go to bed and turn off the light because it was too noisy. You know, I had to like fall asleep on the couch with the TV on and then dive for the bed sometime in the middle of the night. And since I've been about, I don't know, somewhere around 9 months sober, I've been able to just turn out the light and go to bed. And I didn't even know that was something I wanted. You know, but it sure was something I couldn't do before. But I knew you were all talking about me. I knew you didn't like me. Everybody in my head knew you didn't like me. You know, I just had this thing going on. I couldn't make a move without being aware of how you saw it. You know what I mean? It's like I was a spectator in my own life out here watching everybody else watch me. And I couldn't be talking to somebody over here without seeing you guys out of the corner of my eye. And do we look like we're having fun? And do, you know, but you wish you were my friend. And all, just on and on and on. And if I did anything dumb, I knew you would tell your friends and they would tell their friends and they would tell their, like that old Brett commercial, remember that? You know, and she told her friend and she told her, and all of a sudden there's 80 faces on the screen. And I mean, it just was hard work doing anything. And I had these two rules that I lived by that my parents never taught me. One was don't ever, 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 ever admit that you have made a mistake. You know, never let them see that you're wrong. Now, I had a one-night stand drag out into 5 years of marriage based on that one. And and the other one was that it wasn't all right not to know. It was not okay not to know any, whatever. You know, whatever it was, I was doing fake it till you make it long before I got here, because I couldn't let you know that I didn't know, because somehow that would make me look bad. I mean, I got embarrassed for kids in school to ask questions in class, because my God, now the whole class knows you don't know anything. You know, I mean, I just couldn't. And so life was very black and white to me because I couldn't ask questions. So you either knew how to do something or you didn't. You know, you had that gift or you didn't. And it wasn't until I got sober that I put together little things like my friends who could play the piano were the same ones who couldn't come out and play because they had piano lessons or because they had to practice their piano. You know, I mean, it was just like they sat down and played and I thought, how nice for you, you know, and I can't play the piano. And in hitting junior high when everybody's trying to learn how to wear makeup, and I was, in the late 60s, early 70s with all the eyeliner, and I would try it and it would look stupid and I would think, well, some people just have faces for that stuff and some don't. It never occurred to me that my friends were like putting it on, taking it off, putting it on, you know, practicing. That whole concept of practice, of work toward a goal to achieve the goal, just escaped me. You know, I mean, my outlook on life from just when I was like, just give me the goal. You know, I mean, what's this work for it stuff? If it was hard, I just didn't do it. You know, if I couldn't win, I didn't want to play. If I had to try anything more than three times, I didn't do it. And it's just the way it was, because I didn't want you to see me working at anything, because if you saw me try and then I failed, it would just be twice as humiliating. So I just didn't try anything new in public. And my kids were 4 and 6 when I got sober. They weren't in my custody at the time, but my 4-year-old, I would have told you, was going to be here by now. I mean, I had a boy and a girl, Robbie and Sarah, and Sarah just had that gleam in her eye, you know, that gleam. And she could lie and just not miss it, you know, just, it was talent. I mean, it's just talent. And I mean, when Chuck and I got married, the kids were 7 and 9 when we got married, or 8 and 10. But we used to tell people, you know, most people save for college, we're saving for treatment. But when she was 11, she wanted to be on a swim team. She started getting weird on us when she was 11. She wanted to be on a swim team. Some of her friends were on a team. And we took her to try out, and the coach told her, well, you can be on the swim team if, you know, I think you've got potential. You can be on the team. But you should practice down in age group, because you can't keep up with your age group yet, even at practice. Now, she's 11 years old, and he wants her to practice with the 9-year-olds. And this was okay with her. You know, I could not have done that at age 11, because how's that going to look if I'm swimming with the 9-year-olds? And I'm always a little embarrassed to admit I was 7 years sober when this happened, and I was having kind of a hard time being the mom of the 11-year-old that was swimming with the 9-year-olds, because how am I going to look, you know? What's wrong with your kid? And I didn't understand what they meant when they said we're self-centered when I got here. Oh, God, you got to watch out for us smart ones. We are hard. So anyway, this is fine with her. She starts practicing with the 9-year-olds. At the first swim meet, these were USS teams, so, you know, big meets, multi-teams. They just post the results. And she was 70th out of 72 in her first race. And she went back to the swim meet the next day. I would have been trying to get my parents to relocate, you know. And we told her after that swim meet, okay, Sarah, you know, you didn't win, but you got a baseline time now. And next time you swim, even if you don't win again, if you beat that time, you've had a successful race, even if you don't win. Now, the whole time I'm telling her this, I'm thinking, yeah, right. successful race. I mean, my parents told me that stuff when I swam, and I knew they just had to tell me that stuff. I knew it wasn't for real. It's just what the self-esteem building stuff you tell your kids, you know. She beat her time and she was happy, you know. Now, the rest of the story is that 2 years later, she was a state AA swimmer, you know. And she swam all over the Midwest. I mean, we went to swim meets in Indiana and Michigan and Kentucky, all over the place. And I would have missed every bit of that the day they told me to practice with the 9-year-olds. And at 11 years old, she had never had a drink, and neither had I, you know? And I always try to tell that story, because what it opened up for me, I mean, I knew by then my thinking was off, you know what I mean? But I still don't think I had really fully realized how far off my thinking was before I ever took a drink. That at age 11, I could not have done what she did because of what people would have said, and God forbid somebody laugh at me. And she was just fine with it all. You know, somehow she internalized, set a goal, worked for the goal, achieved the goal, you know. And Chuck and I were just watching, fascinated, because we, you know, we're like, is this normal thinking? I don't know. You know, do you know what normal? I don't know. We just figured we kind of keep an eye on her and see what happened. And she just, you know, she just took that turn on us. She got a summer job and she saved $500. I mean, who does that? And she, you know, when she graduated from high school, she still had the same friends that she'd had in kindergarten. She hadn't had to change schools 3 times. She hadn't had to change friends 3 times. You know, she came home from, they opened up a Starbucks in our town when she was a junior in high school, and she came home from school and said, oh, you know, we went to Starbucks after school. And I was, oh, great, who'd you go with? And she said, you know, Lindsay, Katie, and Jennifer. And I said, her? And she just looks up at me and said, for God's sakes, Mom, that was 6th grade. Could you let it go? To this day, I don't like that girl, you know? She just, you know, she doesn't keep resentments. We hit the point where she was 14, and we said, you know, there's supposed to be one mature person in the house. Congratulations, we think it might be you. I still ask her to sponsor me every now and then. She's 24 years old. She's married. She's in the Army on her second enlistment. You know, she knew somewhere in junior high she wanted to be in the Army, and she signed up for delayed entry program while she was in high school and went in, and she's currently at Fort Hood, Texas, you know, with a husband and a baby, and she's doing what she wants to do, and it just amazes me, you know, because I just never had any, you know, what I first thought about that was her reaction to life is so different than mine. And, you know, the more I think about it, I think the difference is that she doesn't react to life. She just does life. You know what I mean? She just lives it. And I'm a reactor, you know, like a ball in the pinball machine. I'll just be heading this way and then bounce off something and end up over here and bounce off something and end up over there. You know, I'm an accountant by trade, and I just think I ended up there because it was the path of least resistance. You know what I mean? I was born in Northern California. My parents moved to Ohio when I was 2 1/2, and that was my first resentment. I just did not want to be from Ohio. And again, who knows what that's about other than that my thinking at a young age told me if I lived somewhere else, it would be better. If I had different parents, it would be better. If I had long hair, you know, I joke sometimes that I had short hair till 7th or 8th grade because my mom liked short hair, and I'm pretty sure that's why I'm alcoholic. That if I'd had long straight hair like Marsha Brady, I probably wouldn't be here. But, you know, I hated Ohio. When I found out it was warm other places, that's where I wanted to live. I spent all my middle school years campaigning to get my family to move south. They wouldn't do it. I finally went without them. But you know, there was just something about Ohio. I remember being in first grade looking at a map of the United States and seeing the Pacific Coast and Texas and Florida and then Ohio, you know? And I just thought you could look at a map and tell that nothing is happening in Ohio. So I wanted out because I knew life would be better, you know? And I got through. I didn't drink till I was 15. I'm not sure why, you know, I just didn't. But once I started, boy, it was on. Because from the very beginning, I had a huge capacity for alcohol. And I drank with the big boys because I could. You know, I was always much more, I was kind of laughing looking at this table over here. I thought that would have been me, one girl with 10 guys, you know. Sorry. Don't look. You know, I drank with the big boys because I could, because, you know, I mean, who wants to hang out with girls? When I got to AA and they said hang out with women, I was horrified. I just thought, you have got to be kidding me. I didn't even drink with women. Why would I want to hang out with them sober, you know? I mean, in high school when the girls would drink, they would fall down and throw up and giggle, and I mean, some of them were pink in public, and I just, you know, and then when we got older, it was just more complicated drinking with women, because, you know, uncomfortable conversations came up, like, oh, that was your husband, I, you know, sorry. It just was so much easier to drink with men, And I could, you know, I had a huge capacity for alcohol, and I just loved it from the beginning. I never was a falling down drunk or a throwing up drunk, or I just was happy when I drank, you know. I'm all for morning drinking. My outlook was, if you could drink in the morning, why wouldn't you, you know? I never had those, for one thing, when you're drinking in high school, you have to drink early. It's only practical to drink in the morning because you have to sober up before your parents get home, you know. So that really doesn't count as morning drinking anyway, but for, you know, I just didn't have all those lines in the sand, like, well, I won't do this. Well, I did have one. I always say my parents should have caught on to this because, you know, I grew up in a college town, and so we had just drug education starting in first and second grade, you know, because all the college students. And in sixth grade, I'm watching TV, sixth and seventh grade, and that was back when it'd be on the nightly news if there was some big drug bust somewhere, you know. And sixth and seventh grade, I'm going, good, I'm glad they caught those nasty drug dealers. And eighth, ninth grade, I'm going, oh, my God, do you know what that would be worth on the street, you know? But they didn't catch on to that little change in my attitude. Anyway, and I did do a lot of other stuff. I'm a child of the 70s. It was there, and quite frankly, if you have it, I'll take it. You know, my favorite is yours. And but it was all about the alcohol. You know, I mean, I started with alcohol. I threw a bunch of stuff in the middle. And one by one by one, as those things started to interfere with my drinking, they had to go, you know, because by the end, anything that interfered with my drinking had to go. And that included my children, that included my employability, that included my integrity, that included any drug that came down the pike. The only one I ever miss is the diet pills, you know, periodically, because it's the only time in my life that I could drink for days. I was thin and my house was clean, you know, it's like... By the time I was 25, I couldn't even. I would hate me after 2 days of that. So, you know, I just, they all had to go. Everything that came between me and a drink fell by the wayside. And I got through high school somehow, just probably because I didn't drink till I was 15. And I went off to college. This has been the great mystery to me this year. As bad as I hated the Midwest and as many warm places on earth as there were, just this year I went, why did I go to college in Indiana? You know, I mean, it's like, I don't have a clue, but probably path of least resistance is all I can figure out. So I ended up, you know, I went off to college with high test scores because I'm a test taker, you know. Give me a few minutes to study it. I can spit it back at you on a test. Now, I can't tell you what I read 20 minutes later, but who cares? We got the A on the test. And so I had very high, you know, ACT and SAT scores, and I got over to school, and I had a 1.8 at the end of my first semester because I just couldn't go to class, you know. And I wasn't drinking a lot over there because it was a 21 state. I had put myself geographically in the middle of a 21 state at 17 years old, and I was miserable over there. But I couldn't go to class because, you know, I don't know how to talk to people. I don't know, that whole conversation thing still escapes me a little bit, you know. And if I walk into a big room full of people, it separates into two groups, all of them and me, you know. And I don't know what to say after my name's Beth, because you're just staring at me now, you know. It's like, I don't know how people do that. How do they just talk? You know, I got 80 people up here trying to anticipate what you're going to say so I can select an answer. And so, you know, what happens then is I'll meet somebody and I'll say, hi, my name's Beth. And she might say, hi, my name's Terry. And you know, now everybody has started. Say something. You're just staring at her. Don't talk now. You'll look dumber, you know. What are you going to say after all this time? So it's like they're all arguing. I'm paralyzed. We have to go. And can't go back there again. So college did not go well for me because I just couldn't, you know, I just couldn't do that. I always felt like if I said my name's Beth, you were just waiting for the rest. You know what I mean? Like, Beth was not enough. It was not enough. I had to be Beth the night auditor, Beth the cheerleader, Beth, you know, Jim and Sally's daughter. I grew up in a little town, or Beth on Honor Society, or Beth. When I was in junior high, I was busy, busy, busy. And in my first year in high school, I mean, cheerleading, pep club, honor society, yearbook staff, student council, you name it, I was doing it. Busy, busy, busy. Because I cannot sit alone in a quiet place. It's too noisy, you know? And when I drank, those things started to go away one at a time. Because I didn't need them anymore to be okay, you know? Some of them got taken away. Like, apparently they frown on cheerleaders skipping school for Green Beer Day. Who knew that? You know, they came in the bar and got us all out when we were supposed to be in school. And other things I gave away and other things I didn't even notice were gone. You know, one of the things that's happened since I've been sober is these whole pieces of my life had come back that I didn't even know were missing. Because alcoholism is subtle and it's cunning. And it just stripped me of everything one at a time. And so anyway, I flunk out of college, I go back to Ohio, I get a job in a bank because I figure that's, you know, because here's my parents now, everybody's watching, right? I've disgraced my parents. And I got a job in a bank, but they work Monday mornings, and that just wasn't working out for me. And a friend of mine said, we should go to Florida, and I said, we should, you know, let's. And we just left. I mean, you know, Sunday night we're talking about it. Monday morning we're on the road. I mean, I had wanted to run away from home since I was 12 years old. You know, finally I got the chance. Although I was one of those kids, I still have, I was a, like, a, to this day, if I was driving through the desert and there was a stop sign, I would stop. I don't know why. And so even when I wanted to run away, I always just wanted to like run away during spring break. You know what I mean? Like I'll be back before school starts. But anyway, I finally had my chance to get out. I'm running away from home. You know, I waited till my parents went to work and I came home and packed and kind of left little, women were disappearing back then. So I did leave kind of something that indicated I had left voluntarily. And I went down to Florida and I had worked in a convenience store in Ohio, so I immediately applied to a stop and go in Bonita Springs, Florida. And, I got a job, and immediately what I didn't know down there was it was really trance. So if you were at work 3 days in a row, you were management material. So by the time I called my mom two weeks later, you know, I was like, don't worry, though, I'm assistant manager at this store. And she said, you know, she asked me this question. She goes, why didn't you just tell us you were leaving? And I'm thinking, that would kind of defeat the purpose of running away from home, you know. But she pointed out that I was 19 years old and I could have just left. I mean, I didn't even know, you know what I mean? I was on the run at 19. So, you know, I got to Florida. Those were my people. The whole town was 3 miles long, and they stopped at this end of town to buy beer to drink on the way to the bar on this end of town. Those are my people. And, my alcoholism caught up with me fast down there because there were no more checks and balances on it. And by the end of 8 months, it was becoming, I was out of places to live. I was out of places to work. I was out of guys to date, you know, because there was only 3 bars in town, and I did most of my dating at Last Call. And you never know when True Love's gonna strike. But I mean, you know, I'm sure I'm not the only bar dater in here. You know, if you meet at the bar you're dating, and if they're still there on Sunday, it's a relationship. Anyway, I was running out of options, and it was looking like I was gonna have to go back to Ohio. You know, which would have been admitting I made a mistake. Admitting I couldn't take care of myself, you know, not to mention going back to Ohio. And this guy moved into town from California about then. And, I've got a friend in Cincinnati who said that they really should just put a sign at the state line of Florida, California, and Arizona that say this state doesn't work either. So we could all just, you know, I'd get to the state line and go, oh, crap, and just turn around and go home. Because, you know, Florida was one of my, it'll be better here. I never figured out where the California people run away. Did you guys, like, go to Idaho or somewhere when you go? Anyway, you know, this guy moved into town from California, and that was my one-night stand that dragged on into the marriage. And he had everything I was looking for in a guy like Beverly talked about. He had a house, a car, and a job. You know, I found out later the house was his uncle's, you know, the car, he had the money to buy the car, but he didn't have the money to fix the car, and the job was very temporary. But, we got together, and for the next 5 years, it was just stupid is the only word I can ever come up with, you know, the whole thing was just stupid. And we did have the 2 children in that marriage, and they're my evidence that God can turn any chaos to good, you know. I love my kids dearly. But we were just not destined to be together, and which he actually pointed out about 20 days into the relationship. But I said, oh, no, Kurt, because he was saying how different we were, you know, and it probably wouldn't last in the long run. And I'm like, oh, no, that white-collar stuff, that's my parents' world. That means nothing to me, you know. But inside, I'm thinking, oh, you are so right, you know, you big loser, you. But if I had said that out loud, I would have had to find somewhere else to live and somebody else's car to drive. And, when I saw that line in the book that talked about, you know, selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem, and then what it goes on to say after that just staggered me, because it kept me from having to write 100 pages on that marriage. Because what it said was, you know, people retaliate. We step on others' toes and they retaliate. And that sometimes it seems like we haven't done anything to deserve it. But then it says if we look, you know, at some time in the past, we invariably have made a decision based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. And I was like, oh my God, there it is. Every crappy relationship I ever had, there was a moment of clarity at the very beginning when I knew this is not the one, but I would make that decision based on self. Yeah, but, you know, it's a house, or it's a whatever, or my favorite, he'll change. You know, and that was the deal with this. I knew early on it was doomed, but, you know, I didn't want to move back to Ohio. So we had the two kids, and it was the same kind of stuff. We went to 4th of July. We went to the Keys on 4th of July when our son was 6 months old. And we liked it, so we came home on Tuesday and moved on Friday with a six-month-old baby and $400. You know, hey, Mom, move to the Keys, but don't worry, I'm assistant manager at this restaurant, you know. And she is not an alcoholic, and she's always had this bizarre idea that there should be consequences for your actions. I just never really, you know, I'm all about mercy, not justice. And, you know, and so we're in the Keys, and I loved it there. I worked at Oceanfront Resort. I got into their accountant, and I was the night auditor for a while at this resort in the Upper Keys. I got all the drug money down from Miami. It's like all the old quiet money went to Chica Lodge, but Holiday Isle was rocking. And we just, you know, the security guards were all bikers, and I had the keys to all seven bars, and they paid me. You know, it just was a wonderful, wonderful time in my life. And we got into a little trouble down there. I mean, it was really expensive to live in the Keys, so we had a little part-time business going, you know, and home-based. Well, there was a lot of importing and exporting down there, and so, you know, distributorships were easy to come by. And I still remember telling, you know, after I was arrested, telling the probation officer, well, it was just like a part-time job, you know. I mean, it was just, I never wanted to be a kingpin. I just wanted a couple extra $100 a week. I said it was a part-time job, and she just got that look that non-alcoholics get, you know, when we say stuff like that to them, like, makes perfect sense to me. And she's just like, down here, Beth, we call that sale of a controlled substance. I was like, oh. So anyway, you know, I wanted out of the marriage, and I can't leave because that would be saying I made a mistake, but I went out, so I just drank till he can't stand it anymore. And he said, get out, and he only had to say it once. And when he came home to talk at lunch, it was like, no, no, you threw us out, you know. But inside, I was just like, woohoo, I wanted out. So I moved back to Ohio only because my mom wouldn't send me money in Florida. I can't imagine why, you know, but now I had these two babies. In 1984, I moved back to Ohio, and she had moved to Cincinnati by then, so I moved there. I had been to one AA meeting in the Keys, two AA meetings in the Keys, because I got fired from my job that I loved, because I was at happy hour at 5, and I was still there when I was supposed to be clocking in at 11. And so I went to an AA meeting. I thought, oh, what the heck. So in February of 1983, I went to a meeting at the Key Largo Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the Tuesday night Key Largo Group. And I said I was an alcoholic for the first time. Now, I'd been to meetings with my dad. Anytime I came home, he invited me to a meeting. I guess he just wanted me to meet his friends, you know. And I would say, my name's Beth, I'm with him. So this in Key Largo, I said I was an alcoholic. And I called my dad, and I told him I'd been to a meeting, you know, and that I'd said I was an alcoholic. Because you know how we are the first meeting, you know, maybe we will stay sober forever. So now I have to go out and explain to everyone all about that I have this physical allergy to alcohol, and here's why I can't drink any alcohol. And here I've underlined a few parts of the big book you might want to read so you can better understand me. You know, of course, then 3 weeks later, you have to go around and explain to everybody why it's really okay if you have one beer. So anyway, I called my dad, and within a week, I got a box from him, and it had a big book and a 12 and 12 and a tape of his talk and a couple of daily meditation books and some bookmarks, and it's like he'd been gathering it up for years and just thinking, someday I'll mail it, you know. And I got back to Ohio, and I tried, I didn't stay sober down there. I got my job back, so AA works, you know. I didn't want to quit drinking. I didn't want the consequences. So when I moved to Ohio, and I thought, well, maybe there's something to this drinking thing, you know. But I really thought if I just quit drinking with bikers, it would calm down, you know. So I went to AA in Cincinnati, and in 1984, Young People's was huge there. I was 25 years old. I'm 49 now, so you don't have to do the math. And you know, I mean, they had a Monday night Young People's meeting that was 200 people. And they had a Friday night meeting that was 150 people. And Icky Paw had just been there the year before. You were probably there, weren't you? You know, I mean, they were on fire. And it was enthusiastic, fun, you know, just on fire AA. But you know, when I walk into a room full of people, it separates into two groups, all of them and me. And you guys all know each other, and I still don't know what to say after my name's Beth, you know, and you're all talking to each other, and I'm standing there looking, and I gotta go. And I went to the bar, because I can walk into a bar not knowing anybody, and I am fine. Give me $5 and a pool table, and I'm good for the night, because I can play pool. You know, I didn't play good for a girl, I just played good. And I could pay for a lot of drinking, shooting pool, and by the end of the night, I knew who I needed to know. I knew who could drink all night and not fall down, who shot pool as well as I did, and who knew where the party was later. And that was fine. I was perfectly fine going in somewhere like that by myself, but I could not walk into an AA meeting sober. You know, because once you look at me, I disappear. And so, you know, for the most part, it's just kind of on after that. I ended up in treatment in 1985, right after I got charged with child endangerment. And I got charged with child endangerment because my kids were in bed, and I walked down to the corner bar because I had to drink. I had nothing in the house to drink. And my son woke up. He was 3 years old, and he couldn't find me, and he came outside, and he cried, and somebody called the police. You know, and thank God nothing happened to those kids. Or nothing happened in my house while I was gone. It could have, you know. And the police, it didn't take a rocket scientist to figure out where I was. My car was parked right outside, and there was a bar on the corner. So they just called the bar to see if I was there. And when I got there back up, they said, is there somebody you can call to take your kids? Well, I sure don't want to call my mom. I will never hear the end of that, you know. So I said, no, there's really not. I thought maybe they'd go, oh, never mind, and leave. They said, well, then we have to call 241-KIDS. And I went, oh, wait, my mom lives here. So my mom got that 2 a.m. call that nobody wants to get, saying, come get your grandchildren, your daughter's under arrest, you know. And my mom had to get out of bed and drive down and pick up my kids at 2 in the morning while they took me to jail. And it was suggested to me that I go to treatment because maybe I wouldn't go to jail if I went to treatment, because that was an automatic 6-month sentence. And so I went to treatment, you know. It seemed like a good plan. And when I got to treatment, I realized I had signed myself into a 6-week-long all-woman facility. That was just a cruel joke, you know. But it was funny, because I would be the one, you know, now I had a tape of my dad's talk already. I already had my own big book. Even in the mid-80s, it wasn't that common to have sober parents. So I'm already like, you know, I laughed. I was at a beginner's meeting, and a guy talked about when he did outpatient treatment, and then he goes, I aced that class. And I thought, that's what I did with treatment. It was all a big class to me. I'm a test taker. I can say everything that will make me look like most likely to stay sober. And I was the one they would get to talk to women who didn't want to leave their kids for 6 weeks, and I would tell them, better 6 weeks now than forever later. If we're not sober, we can't be parents, you know. But the problem was, the book talks that we have a double life, you know, the one we know is true and the one we want people to see. And the problem was, the whole time I'm telling these women how they should just trust God and come in and do treatment for 6 weeks because if they're not sober, they can't be moms. The whole time that's going on, I'm realizing I don't want my kids back. I am relieved they're gone. I am glad they're at my mother's house. You know, it was hard being a single mom. I just couldn't get it together. And at my mom's house, they got a bath every night. They got a hot dinner every night. They got to daycare on time in clean clothes every day. She read them a story every single night. I could not sit still long enough to read my kids a story. What my kids got from me all the time was, I love you, go away. You know, mommy's busy, you know, go play, go help your sister, go pick up your toys. No, I don't want to go, you know. I mean, I was the kind of mom, I would take them to the zoo and not let them look at anything, you know what I mean? It seemed like a good idea when we went, you know, let's go to the zoo. And we'd get there and we'd look at the bears, and then there'd be a beer stand, you know, and then I'd have to pee, and then I need another beer, but these are $6 a piece, forget that. And we had to go, you know. My kids never saw a thing. And here I am in treatment, and they say, you know, alcoholism makes all your decisions for you. And I'm thinking, well, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. Yeah, I make my own choices. And then I got sober, and I realized my kids did not see the inside of a McDonald's when I drank. They don't sell beer in there. Why would I go in? You know, I take them to the drive-thru for a Happy Meal because I had a bottle of rum in the car I could dump in the Coke. But we didn't. Thank God Cincinnati was a good German town, or they never would have gone any. But they sold beer at the zoo, and they sold beer at the pool, and they sold beer at Kings Island. So, you know, they got to do a few things. But I just, you know, I didn't go to movies. I'd sober up in the middle of the movie, you know. But it's not making my decisions. So anyway, I've got this double life going, you know, I don't want my kids. I know I don't want my kids. I can't tell you I don't want my kids. How you talk about looking bad for somebody that doesn't want to look bad. You know, that's just like the ultimate sin. And so I would tell you, if you asked me, of course I want to be sober and get my kids back. But inside, I knew it was a lie, and that double life was building. And the other thing that happened while I was in treatment was that my dad died. You know, he was a sober member of AA, and I was going to come out and be Jim's daughter. And he died the 10th day I was in treatment. And I was devastated, because now what, I don't know how to walk in and just be Beth. I can't do that. I was going to be Jim's daughter. And I was the only child of divorced parents, so I got the insurance money. And it was on. And for the next 2.5 years, I drank the way I wanted to drink, and the kids stayed at my mom's. I would make periodic attempts to clean up, but they never lasted long, you know. And I just, I don't know. I remember when I got sober in 1988, and I remember thinking, you know, if I was that miserable the last 2 years I drank, why didn't I just go to AA? It's not like I didn't know it was there. And then I heard a guy talk one night, and he talked about, you know, being so miserable and just knowing he was going to be miserable another day. He goes, you know, the thing was, I knew if I didn't drink, I was going to be miserable. And if I knew if I drank, I would probably be miserable. But there was always that chance that this might be the one time that I had a good time drinking, you know, like there was hope in that bottle. And I realized that's what it was. It just, you know, it's going to be different this time. It's going to be different this time. And I drank for the next 2.5 years until it was kind of a race to see what would expire first, me or the money. And because I never thought I'd live to be 30. You know, I didn't really have any plans to be 30 because I figured I'd be dead. I mixed drugs and alcohol. I bartended places where people shot at each other. You know, I rode motorcycles when I couldn't walk. I had my own Harley. Thank you very much. I just, you know, and... In June of 1988, I ended up in detox. I had taken off to Florida because it seemed like we should all have T-shirts to just say it seemed like a good idea at the time, you know. One day I thought, you know, I've been in Ohio 4 years, and I bet they're all going, God, I wish Beth would come back. So I went down to Florida for my homecoming parade and didn't get a parade, and at the end of a week, I took my mom's credit card to go down there. Well, I had one of hers that she let me carry for emergencies, and this seemed like an emergency to me, so I took off, and at the end of the week, the card was tired, and so was I, and I couldn't, because I just got a one-way ticket down there, because I was never coming back, and, you know, at the end of a week, I tried to book a thing home. On Sunday, June 26, 1988, I was in the Fort Myers, Florida airport, and the credit card would not, it just couldn't bear the burden of a plane ticket, And I didn't know what to do, you know. I didn't even have a dollar, and I didn't have a plan, you know, because if I have enough for a drink, one drink, and I can come up with a plan, you know. I thought about, like, stealing some little old lady's purse. There's a lot of retired people down there, but I felt so bad that day that I knew I would pick on the little old lady that still did aerobics twice a week, and she would run me down and take her purse back, and I'd be arrested by the airport security and really look bad, You know, I couldn't bear the thought of being asked to leave the airport bar because it would have been obvious I was waiting around for somebody to buy me a drink. So I called my mom and told her what I had done and where I was, because nobody knew where I was, you know. That was back before all the electronics with the credit cards. So she said, well, call me back in a couple hours. And she hung up. And when I called her back, she said, I booked you a ticket, but you need to know that I really am not flying you home. I'm flying the children's mother home, and it's only because I'm afraid, you know, we're afraid we'll never see you again if we don't. And she picked me up at the airport, and I hadn't had a drink all day because I didn't have enough money for a drink. So that was Sunday, June 26, 1988. And she dumped me off at the local detox center in Cincinnati, which was in a horrible section of town. And she said, you know, go in or don't, but you can't come home with me. And it wasn't until about 2 years ago that I really thought about what that must have cost her. I mean, I'm an only child, you know, and this was over the Rhine in Cincinnati for anybody from the Midwest. And for her to leave her only child standing outside and leave, she didn't know that night when she left if she would ever see me again. And she knew she had to do that, you know. And I'm running around saying, I'm not hurting anybody, just leave me alone. You know, it's like, man, we leave wreckage everywhere. You know, people pleasing is my other favorite one. Have you ever had anyone tell you they're a people pleaser, and then if you ask them, well, how many please people have you left in your wake? We really need a new term for that. I can't think of one. Anyway, I went into detox, and the next day I was trying to come up with a plan, you know, because we always got plan B. Alcoholics always got a plan. Even when stuff's going good, we got a plan. Ask somebody where they're working, they'll be like, well, I work here, but if it hits the fan, I'm going over here. You know, I mean, we just always have an escape hatch. And that day, I just didn't have another plan. My sponsor calls it having no friendly direction. I just did not have one better idea on anything to do about my life. I had nobody left to call. I had nowhere left to go. You know, I had everything I could come up with. Well, I could go work here. No, you can't. I could borrow money here. No, you can't. You know, I had tried everything, and it had failed. And like I said, I thought I'd be dead at 30, and I was 29 and a half laying in that detox bed and realized that I was distressingly healthy. That there, I mean, there was nothing. My blood pressure was low. You know, there just was nothing wrong with me. And I should have been dead over and over and over and over and over. And I realized that day I wasn't going to die. And that's the only reason I never tried to kill myself. On some level, I knew I would live, you know, and just maim myself somehow and look bad. So I, you know, forget. And that day in that detox bed, I knew I was going to live. And I knew for a moment, there's a guy in North Carolina, Bill C., and he talks about grace being that moment where we absolutely get a look at things as they are, not as we think they are. You know, and for just that minute, I saw that it was bad, but it hadn't begun to get bad yet, that there was so many more years of bad ahead of me, you know, that right then I still had all my limbs, except for a couple of crowns, I still had all my teeth, I had both eyes, my family was kind of speaking to me, and that there were a lot of 70-year-old winos out there, and I mean, I was working on it in my 20s. I loved Wild Irish Rose, and you know, all those, you know, they're thinking when they make that wine. Not that it's ever seen a grape. I don't know why they call it wine, but, you know, the square bottles, you know, they do not roll out from under the car seat at inopportune times. Very practical. But I have to share this with you, too. When I was in the Crown Room in Salt Lake City, and this kid walks up. They I guess they have free drinks in there. I don't know. I never was in there when I drank. I probably never would have left. But the... you know, I mean, I'm guilty of Jack and Coke and a few, you know, I've polluted some good whiskey with soda pop, but I'm sitting there doing my work, and I hear this kid order two drinks, because I don't know about you, but I never found anything that would go in scotch besides ice. I mean, it just all tasted foul. And he walks up, and he orders Crown Royal and Coke and Maker's Mark with Diet Coke. And I'm texting my husband going, like, I'm going to puke, man. It's like, some people just shouldn't drink, you know? Maker's Mark and Diet Coke. Oh, anyway. So, I don't know how I got there either. You're getting my jet lag today. I'm sorry. So, anyway, I knew I was going to live. That's what it was. I drifted off on the Wild Irish Rose. I knew I was going to live, and I just had this passing thought of, you know, whatever those people in AA are doing seems to be working for them, and whatever you're doing clearly is not working for you. Maybe you ought to just try it their way. You know, and it was just that little quiet voice, and I would not have told you that was going to be my surrender. I mean, I was a biker, for God's sakes. You know what I mean? Rock on. I am down in flames, blaze of glory when I go. You know, do it big or don't do it at all. And I had no idea that when I surrendered, it was just going to be this little pathetic voice that said, oh, screw it. You know? That's still how I surrender most of the time. You know, okay. Nothing graceful. So I went to AA. You know, I wanted to go through treatment. Because a 30-day rest was sounding good. But they had a 30-day program there, and they said no. I was insulted. I would think they'd want me to succeed. You know, but what they said to me probably saved my life, because they said, you know what, Beth? You know every single thing we're going to tell you in there. Why don't you just go do it and leave the bed space for somebody that doesn't have the information? And it was like, oh, you know, I never thought about taking up space and treatment, being a bed somebody who needed it, you know? I was just looking for the rest. And chances are, if I'd gone through there 30 days, I would have come out and done what I always did, because I would have been rested up and feeling better. But I got out and I went to a meeting because I didn't know what else to do. I almost didn't go to a meeting the first day because, hey, I'd been going 5 days in a row. I could take a day off, you know. But this voice in my head said, you know, you skipped meetings before and you drank. So I went to the meeting. And the very first night I was there, a woman was speaking that I had met when I passed through in 1984. And she was speaking that night, and she was 4 years sober 4 years later. Imagine that. And she told a room full of people, like Friday night at Oak Street was about 200 people. And she told a room full of people that alcoholism had taken her to the space where she didn't want to work and she didn't want to take care of her daughter. She just wanted to drink. And I had never before heard anyone say they didn't want to care for their child. That was my biggest secret. And she's telling a room full of people. And I got her phone number that night. And the next day I went to call her and I'm she was just being nice. Everybody's in motion, you know. She'll say, Beth, who? She'll, you know. But one voice up here said, well, you know, you didn't call people before and you drank. So I called her. And I just said, this is Beth. I got your phone number last night, and I have no idea what to say to you, so I am practicing using the phone. And she just laughed and said that's what she had to do, you know, because it was the first time I told the truth. And that's what I tell new people when I give them, you know, if I give you my number, just call me and tell me you're practicing. Because, you know, we're not going to have deep philosophical conversations when you're 3 days sober. And, I was doing good to remember my name. So, but I could practice, you know, I could practice. And so I got in the habit of using the phone. So when I had to use the phone, it was a habit. One of the things that they told me, because we didn't all have cell phones back then. I can't believe I'm talking about 1988 like it was the dark ages, but we didn't all have cell phones. We didn't all have voicemail. It would just, you know, you had your answering machine that sounded like it was underwater, you know, and speed dial was new. That was the big new toy in the late 80s, speed dial. So I'm, you know, proudly thinking to myself, I'll put my sponsor on speed dial, because doesn't that sound cute and clever? I've got my sponsor on speed dial. And somebody said, don't put your sponsor on speed dial. And I said, why not? And they said, because if you're out somewhere besides home and your ass is falling off, memory 5 is not going to do a thing for you at a payphone. I'll tell you what. To this day, I call my sponsor every Monday at 11:45, and every Monday I dial her number, 402-291-5283. And if you don't know your sponsor's phone number because it's in your cell phone, I suggest you learn it, because cell phones get lost and broken, you know. I know my sponsor's phone number. And so I started calling my sponsor, and I started going to meetings. I went to these noon big book meetings at Oak Street because they were at noon, for one thing, so I'd have my whole day free, because I was going to maybe go in a halfway house, but I wasn't sure, and I couldn't get in for a month. I had some loose ends to clean up, like impounded vehicles and pending tickets and stuff like that. So I made this commitment to go to a meeting every day. And there was this noon big book meeting at 405 Oak Street in Cincinnati, which was perfect, because now I'm done at 1 o'clock. I got my whole day free. You know, and they read the book every day. They read a whole chapter every day through 11, then they'd start over, do the preface and forewords, do the doctor's opinion, a chapter a day, start over. So, because you know, if you've been around AA or in treatment, that you're supposed to read your book at home. I mean, you should read your book every day. So I think this is great. This will count. You know, I don't have to read at home. Plus, I couldn't read at home anyway, because if I opened the book, I would be like 20 minutes later still staring at the same paragraph because my brain was sawdust, or I'd be 20 pages in and have no idea what I read, you know, and I would try like concentrate, just read one paragraph, you know, and I'd read it and read it and close the book and it would be gone. The retention was not good. And when you guys read it, I heard it a little more, you know, because they went around the room and they read the chapter. And I know it was sinking in, because one day I was 2 or 3 weeks sober, and I was I'd gone to work answering phones for my mom at her accounting office, because I was unemployable, really, and that was something I was capable of doing. But I could, like, go in at 9, leave at 11 for the noon meeting, go back at 2 and work till 4. That was about it. And I had gone to the noon meeting, and I was on my way back, and I had to stop and run an errand. And on my way into the store, I stopped to see what we were all talking about, you know, because they're all still up there. So I pop in to see what they're all discussing, and somebody in my head is going, that was really cool what Guy said at the meeting today. And somebody else is going, yeah, I didn't know that was in a book, did you? And somebody else is going, I didn't know that was in a book. And I just remember thinking, God, the voices in my head are getting sober, you know? It's like, they're listening. So, And the third reason I loved that meeting was because they reading the whole chapter chewed up half of the meeting time, so chances were better I wouldn't have to talk, you know, because, I mean, I don't want to look bad. I was one of those people when they're reading going around, I'd be counting people, trying to figure out what paragraph I would have, you know, so I could read through a couple times, be sure I, you know, had it down good. And then some yo-yo would read two paragraphs and screw everything up. There's one in every meeting, and... So anyway, those were all my reasons for going to the Big Book meeting, day free at one, don't have to read at home, and won't have to share. But God's got a great sense of humor, and what happened because I was at that meeting every day was, A, my day was free at one, and at about 4:30, I'd remember I had no life. So, you know, I'd be getting a little antsy by six, so I would just go back to the AA clubhouse and hang out there for the 8:30 meeting, because I knew if I was there, I wouldn't get a beer. You know, and they had midnight meetings back then, which was good because I was a bar drinker. I had to be somewhere late at night, you know. And then, like I told you, the people in my head were absorbing a little bit of it too. So they were hearing. And the third biggest thing, you know, the biggest joke on me was I didn't realize that people who go to Big Book meetings on purpose tend to read the book and do what it says. And what I had done out of laziness was plop myself down into the most active people in Cincinnati Alcoholics Anonymous. Right in the middle of them, the intergroup office manager was in there, you know, they just sucked me in. They had me answering phones at intergroup 10 days sober, you know. They had me there on Tuesday and Friday, so I couldn't drink in between, you know. And I just, you know, what a miracle, because I just dove in. Like I said, I was out of ideas, and for whatever reason, this time when I started feeling better, I just stuck with the AA, you know. And I just, I mean, early on, somebody said, Beth, you've been around before. Why don't you write an inventory? And I went, okay. I didn't know I could plead like, oh, I'm not ready. So, I mean, I wrote my fourth step at 3 weeks sober, you know. And that woman who was talking that Friday night heard my fifth step and became my sponsor. And I was making amends. I mean, my life took off. I have never looked back, you know. I am so glad I didn't have somebody telling me, whoa, wait, you know, step a month, step a year. I couldn't have gone even 3 or 4 months without writing an inventory because there was too much noise in my head and I had to get it out. So anyway, I just started showing up, and really from that day to this, that's what I have done. I have been in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started seeing my kids a little more, and they would come on the weekends. And at first I started, the very first amend I made to my children was to stop making promises I couldn't keep. You know, because when I got sober, my word was worth nothing to them. I had no integrity. I had no honor. They couldn't count on me. I didn't show up when I was supposed to, you know. And so my first amend was to just stop making promises I couldn't keep. So I would make one promise to one child and keep it. And I would make one promise to one child and keep it. You know, I took my son wanted to go to a Reds game. So we went to a Reds game. I was 3 weeks sober. It was July in Cincinnati. It was 90-something degrees. It was a three-hit ball game. The score was 1-0 in the second inning, and it was still 1-0 in the seventh inning. And I'm looking around going, this is why you drink, you know? I mean, God, a lot of beer in Cincinnati baseball games. But you know what? Robbie and I just ate one of everything, you know? Well, we had the malt, Mommy. Now what do you want? Let's try the pizza, you know? And we just worked our way around every concession there. And he's 26 years old now and 6 feet tall. And that's still a fond moment for us. You know, we still classify baseball games as eating events. And my daughter wanted to go on a little riverboat ride and dress up like ladies. And so we did that, and little at a time. And I brought them to meetings with me, not because I wanted to involve them in my recovery, but because I knew I'd yell at them all weekend if I didn't go to meetings. So they came to meetings with me, and you guys taught me how to talk to my kids, because I don't know how to talk to them. I am not an intuitive parent, you know. My first thought is me. What about me? I mean, when Chuck and I got together, we agreed that we would always have God first in our life and AA second, and then each other. You know, that I don't want to be first in his life, because then God isn't, you know what I mean? And he'll never be first in mine, because God's got to be there first in AA. And I tell him on a good day, he's third, if I'm not thinking about me, you know? Then he's fourth. But, you know, my kids, who had been invisible around me because I was so deep in my alcoholism, flourished at Alcoholics Anonymous because you guys talked to them and you called them by name. And when you saw them next week, you asked them how their soccer game was last week. And you asked them to help you carry coffee cups, and you colored with them. And their gaze came up off the floor, and they started to look the world in the eye, and I learned how to talk to my kids by watching you guys talk to my kids. You know, AA is not just where I learned to be sober. It's where I learned to be married. It's where I learned to be employed. It's where I learned to be a parent. You know, watch the people who are walking the walk, you know, and do what they do. They told me, I heard early when I was in, some girl had just gone back to college, and she said, it's the coolest thing. If you just do college like you do AA, show up early, sit in front, read the book, listen to the speaker. Dean's list, you know? Chuck and I both went to college on the AA plan. We're a two master's degree household now. We are educated wildly beyond any intellect that we have, but, you know? Alcoholics Anonymous, show up, sit in front, read the book, you know. Work, show up early, sit where you're supposed to sit, listen to the person you're supposed to listen to. I mean, it just, you know, it's just that easy. And since I got here, I've become employable, and I've become a wife. You know, Chuck and I met in AA, and we will be married 16 years this coming July, and we're having a great time, you know. We still like each other. We still like hanging out together. We enjoy spending time together. And, you know, what a gift to get that here. And my kids, you know, my daughter turned out to not be alcoholic. And our son, the jury's still out. But, you know, he knows where to go. He knows where to go. And he knows neither one of us will try to sponsor him. So, you know, it's just, it's all good. He's 26. He's engaged. He lives in Raleigh now. And, my daughter, like I said, is 24 in Texas, and sometimes I forget to tell people that, yes, we did actually get custody of the children, although I did not get them back when I was a year sober. My mom and I talked, and when I was a year sober, they had been with her for 4 years by then, because I didn't get sober right after she took them. I drank another 3 years. And when I was a year sober, we talked, and she lived in a nice neighborhood with one of the best school districts in the state. And they had friends there that they'd had for 4 years. And they had, you know, their life was stable there. I was the disruption in their life. And it didn't seem right to, I lived in a 10th floor efficiency in a cheap part of town in the Cincinnati Public School District. It just didn't make a lot of sense to drag them down to my level in the name of family unity, you know. They had done what they were supposed to do. I was the disruption. And so we agreed that I would catch up to them. I would go back to school till I was making a little more money, and I would move closer to where they were, and then we would talk. So I actually didn't take custody of my children back until 1993. They came to live with us earlier in 93, but then, you know, Chuck and I, in the summer of 93, we found a house in their neighborhood, which we thought was a misprint the first time we read the ad for it, because it was $20,000 less than any house that was in that neighborhood. I mean, it just wasn't a cheap neighborhood. And we had my daughter for a year, actually, because she and my mom had some problems. And so we just drove her over to where she went to school. But when my son, it just became obvious it was time for Robbie to come too, and we couldn't drive two of them back. You know, that was like a bit dishonest, since none of us would have lived in the school district. And so we just said, well, whatever, God, if we're supposed to have them change schools, we will. Just let us know. And Chuck finds this ad for this house, you know, in Madera for a ridiculously low price, and we called because we thought it was a misprint, and they said, no, it's for real, come on over. And it turned out, you know, it's these two women that like to buy in rehab houses, and one of them was the college roommates of an Al-Anon speaker that's probably been out here speaking. She loved AA, she, you know, on and on and on. We got the house, and my kids started 5th and 7th grade walking out the front door of their parents' house like every other kid in their neighborhood, you know, and that's because Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, great, you know, I missed the first half, I'll get the second half. Well, you know, you forget these cute little kids turn into teenagers. It was a long couple years with my son, and we really had a while where we didn't know if we'd ever all sit in the same room again. You know, it was very, very, very bad. And, you know, but we just kept doing what we had to do. And we kept putting one foot in front of the other and doing AA, and our daughter got involved in youth group at church. Because we just said, you know what, we love you and we want to be here for you, but we've got to add in, you know, we've got to go to more meetings right now, not less. And you have grown up with our AA God in the house, but, you know, we don't know that you can get through this just on that relationship, and you need to find a God of your own understanding. And we don't care if you go to Alateen or church, but you need to start to develop your own relationship with God. And She was in seventh grade, and one of the high school students that she really liked went to the church that we had just started going to, and she just went and told her what was going on, and this girl just took her in, and she got active in youth group, and we all got through it, you know. And the book says you'll intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us, and that is so true, you know, that is so true, that I don't have to do the rest of my life. All I have to do today is Saturday. You know, and what a relief that is. Since I've been here, I've learned that God is here. You know, God is just here in the now. And when I get afraid, I'm afraid of what's going to happen. So I have wandered off out into the future, away from God, you know. And when I'm getting angry about what you did, I have wandered off into the past, away from God. And if I just stay right here, right now, everything's okay. And if you're new, I know they said, you know, when we read how it works, it may seem a little odd to you. I was thinking, it's kind of become trendy this year to have AA meetings on TV. Have you noticed that? Like every show's got somebody getting sober. And I'm watching these AA meetings on TV going, no, that's wrong. That's so lame. Everybody will think AA is lame. You can't do that. Oh, my God. And then I realized one day, it's like, that's exactly how it looked to me when I went, right until it didn't. You know what I'm saying? That because hearts get changed here, you know? And there's really no way they can ever portray it on TV that it's not going to just look, because it looked like that to me when I was new. This is not where I wanted to be. You know, this was the last stop on the block for me. And then my heart changed, and now I can't think of anywhere else I'd rather be, you know? And I got that relationship with God as the result of working the steps, which is what the steps tell me. You know, that a spiritual awakening is the awareness of the presence of God. So I become aware of God's presence by working these steps. And what a miracle that is, you know? But anyway, if you're new, and it does all sound strange, especially if you've gotten a sponsor, you might have noticed that you tell them your problem, and then they give you an answer, and you just... has nothing to do with your problem. You know, you got one of those sponsors and you think, I must not have explained it right. You know? Let me try again. And you know, because no matter what the problem is, the answer is like, read your big book, work with a new girl, go to a meeting. You know, no, you don't understand. I don't have any money. Good, good. Go pick up that new girl. You know, but he left me. Well, read the big book. You know, and so no matter what all of these totally non-AA related problems are, they're saying AA is the answer. You know, which just seems so wrong. But really, what I want to tell you is you are way more preconditioned to that thinking than you think you are. Because let's go back. You're sitting in the bar and somebody walks in and says, man, my girlfriend left me. You go, oh, poor Bob, get him a drink, you know? And then somebody else walks in and says, man, I really need money. You know, I'm broke, I may lose my house. Oh, poor Debbie, get her a drink, you know? So now you know, okay, a drink is the answer to my boyfriend left, and a drink is the answer to I need money. You know, and something great happened, you know, oh, get her a drink, you know, okay, so now a drink is the answer to good things, you know, so really, it's like this whole time we were relying on a power greater than ourselves, a drink, to make it better, and so I can just take that. Does that make sense, you know, that the whole, it didn't matter what my problem was when I drank, I relied on one answer, alcohol, and so now my answer is God. So why is that so far-fetched? I was relying on one thing my whole life anyway. I have just changed powers to a power greater than alcohol. Thank you.